Disc 19.
This was the care which he had hitherto abstained from mentioning to Rosamond, and he believed with some wonder that it had never entered her mind, though certainly no difficulty could be less mysterious. It was an inference with a conspicuous handle to it, and had been easily drawn by indifferent observers, that Lydgate was in debt, and he could not succeed in keeping out of his mind for long together that he was every day getting deeper into that swamp which tempts men towards it with such a pretty covering of flowers and verdure. It is wonderful how soon a man gets up to his chin there, in a condition in which, in spite of himself, he is forced to think chiefly of release, though he had a scheme of the universe in his soul. 18 months ago, Lydgate was poor, but had never known the eager want of small sums, and felt rather a burning contempt for any who descended a step in order to gain them. He was now experiencing something worse than a simple deficit. He was assailed by the vulgar, hateful trials of a man who has bought and used a great many things which might have been done without, and which he is unable to pay for, though the demand for payment has become pressing. How this came about may be easily seen without much arithmetic or knowledge of prices. When a man in setting up a house and preparing for marriage finds that his furniture and other initial expenses come to between 400 and 500 pounds more than he has capital to pay for, when at the end of a year it appears that his household expenses, horses and etceteras, amount to nearly 1,000, while the proceeds of the practice, reckoned from the old books to be worth 800 per annum, have sunk like a summer pond and make hardly 500, chiefly in unpaid entries, the plain inference is that whether he minds it or not, he is in debt. Those were less expensive times than our own, and provincial life was comparatively modest. But the ease with which a medical man who had lately bought a practice, who thought that he was obliged to keep 2 horses, whose table was supplied without stint, and who paid an insurance on his life and a high rent for house and garden, might find his expenses doubling his receipts, can be conceived by anyone who does not think these details beneath his consideration. Rosamond, accustomed from her childhood to an extravagant household, thought that good housekeeping consisted simply in ordering the best of everything. Nothing else answered. And Lydgate supposed that if things were done at all, they must be done properly. He did not see how they were to live otherwise. If each head of household expenditure had been mentioned to him beforehand, he would have probably observed that it could hardly come to much. And if anyone had suggested a saving on a particular article, for example, the substitution of cheap fish for dear, it would have appeared to him simply a penny-wise, mean notion. Rosamond, even without such an occasion as Captain Lydgate's visit, was fond of giving invitations, and Lydgate, though he often thought the guests tiresome, did not interfere. The sociability seemed a necessary part of professional prudence, and the entertainment must be suitable. It is true, Lydgate was constantly visiting the homes of the poor and adjusting his prescriptions of diet to their small means. But, dear me, has it not by this time ceased to be remarkable? Is it not rather what we expect in men, that they should have numerous strands of experience lying side by side and never compare them with each other? Expenditure, like ugliness and errors, becomes a totally new thing when we attach our own personality to it, and measure it by that wide difference which is manifest in our own sensations between ourselves and others. Lydgate believed himself to be careless about his dress, and he despised a man who calculated the effects of his costume. It seemed to him only a matter of course that he had abundance of fresh garments. Such things were naturally ordered in sheaves. It must be remembered that he had never hitherto felt the check of importunate debt, and he walked by habit, not by self-criticism. But the check had come. Its novelty made it the more irritating. He was amazed, disgusted, that conditions so foreign to all his purposes, so hatefully disconnected with the objects he cared to occupy himself with, should have lain in ambush and clutched him when he was unaware. And there was not only the actual debt. There was the certainty that in his present position he must go on deepening it. 2 furnishing tradesmen at Brassing, whose bills had been incurred before his marriage, and whom uncalculated current expenses had ever since prevented him from paying, had repeatedly sent him unpleasant letters which had forced themselves on his attention. This could hardly have been more galling to any disposition than to Lydgate's, with his intense pride, his dislike of asking a favour or being under an obligation to anyone. He had scorned even to form conjectures about Mr. Vincey's intentions on money matters, and nothing but extremity could have induced him to apply to his father-in-law, even if he had not been made aware in various indirect ways since his marriage that Mr. Vincey's own affairs were not flourishing, and that the expectation of help from him would be resented. Some men easily trust in the readiness of friends. It had never, in the former part of his life, occurred to Lydgate that he should need to do so. He had never thought what borrowing would be to him. But now that the idea had entered his mind, he felt that he would rather incur any other hardship. In the meantime, he had no money or prospects of money, and his practice was not getting more lucrative. No wonder that Lydgate had been unable to suppress all signs of inward trouble during the last few months. And now that Rosamond was regaining brilliant health, he meditated taking her entirely into confidence on his difficulties. New conversance with tradesmen's bills had forced his reasoning into a new channel of comparison. He had begun to consider from a new point of view what was necessary and unnecessary in goods ordered, and to see that there must be some change of habits. How could such a change be made without Rosamond's concurrence? The immediate occasion of opening the disagreeable fact on her was forced upon him. Having no money, and having privately sought advice as to what security could possibly be given by a man in his position, Lydgate had offered the one good security in his power to the less peremptory creditor, who was a silversmith and jeweller, and who consented to take on himself the upholsterer's credit also, accepting interest for a given term. The security necessary was a bill of sale on the furniture of his house, which might make a creditor easy for a reasonable time, about a debt amounting to less than £400. And the silversmith, Mr. Dover, was willing to reduce it by taking back a portion of the plate and any other article which was as good as new. Any other article was a phrase delicately implying jewellery, and more particularly some purple amethysts costing £30, which Lydgate had bought as a bridal present. Opinions may be divided as to his wisdom in making this present. Some may think that it was a graceful attention to be expected from a man like Lydgate, and that the fault of any troublesome consequences lay in the pinched narrowness of provincial life at that time, which offered no conveniences for professional people whose fortune was not proportioned to their tastes. Also, in Lydgate's ridiculous fastidiousness about asking his friends for money. However, it had seemed a question of no moment to him on that fine morning when he went to give a final order for plate. In the presence of other jewels enormously expensive, and as an addition to orders of which the amount had not been exactly calculated, £30 for ornaments so exquisitely suited to Rosamond's neck and arms could hardly appear excessive when there was no ready cash for it to exceed. But at this crisis, Lydgate's imagination could not help dwelling on the possibility of letting the amethysts take their place again among Mr. Dover's stock, though he shrank from the idea of proposing this to Rosamond. Having been roused to discern consequences which he had never been in the habit of tracing, he was preparing to act on this discernment with some of the rigour, by no means all, that he would have applied in pursuing experiment. He was nerving himself to this rigour as he rode from Brassing and meditated on the representations he must make to Rosamond. It was evening when he got home. He was intensely miserable, this strong man of 29 and of many gifts. He was not saying angrily within himself that he had made a profound mistake, but the mistake was at work in him like a recognised chronic disease, mingling its uneasy importunities with every prospect and enfeebling every thought. As he went along the passage to the drawing-room, he heard the piano and singing. Of course Ladislaw was there. It was some weeks since Will had parted from Dorothea, yet he was still at the old post in Middlemarch. Lydgate had no objection in general to Ladislaw's coming, but just now he was annoyed that he could not find his hearth free. When he opened the door, the two singers went on towards the key note, raising their eyes and looking at him indeed, but not regarding his entrance as an interruption. To a man galled with his harness as poor Lydgate was, it is not soothing to see two people warbling at him as he comes in with the sense that the painful day has still pains in store. His face, already paler than usual, took on a scowl as he walked across the room and flung himself into a chair. The singers, feeling themselves excused by the fact that they had had only three bars to sing, now turned round. "How are you, Lydgate?" said Will, coming forward to shake hands. Lydgate took his hand, but did not think it necessary to speak.
"Have you dined, Tertius? I expected you much earlier," said Rosamond, who had already seen that her husband was in a horrible humour.
She seated herself in her usual place as she spoke.
"I have dined. I should like some tea, please,"
said Lydgate curtly, still scowling and looking markedly at his legs stretched out before him. Will was too quick to need more.
"I shall be off," he said, reaching his hat.
"Tea is coming," said Rosamond. "Pray don't go."
"Yes, Lydgate is bored," said Will,
who had more comprehension of Lydgate than Rosamond had and was not offended by his manner, easily imagining outdoor causes of annoyance.
"There is the more need for you to stay," said Rosamond playfully and in her lightest accent. "He will not speak to me all the evening."
"Yes, Rosamond, I shall," said Lydgate in his strong baritone. "I have some serious business to speak to you about."
No introduction of the business could have been less like that which Lydgate had intended, but her indifferent manner had been too provoking.
"There, you see," said Will. "I'm going to the meeting about the Mechanics Institute. Goodbye."
And he went quickly out of the room. Rosamond did not look at her husband, but presently rose and took her place before the tea tray. She was thinking that she had never seen him so disagreeable. Lydgate turned his dark eyes on her and watched her as she delicately handled the tea service with her taper fingers and looked at the objects immediately before her, with no curve in her face disturbed, and yet with an ineffable protest in her air against all people with unpleasant manners. For the moment he lost the sense of his wound in a sudden speculation about this new form of feminine impassibility, revealing itself in the sylph-like frame which he had once interpreted as the sign of a ready intelligent sensitiveness. His mind glancing back to Laure while he looked at Rosamond, he said inwardly, "Would she kill me because I wearied her?" And then, "It is the way with all women." But this power of generalizing, which gives men so much the superiority in mistake over the dumb animals, was immediately thwarted by Lydgate's memory of wondering impressions from the behaviour of another woman, from Dorothea's looks and tones of emotion about her husband when Lydgate began to attend him, from her passionate cry to be taught what would best comfort that man for whose sake it seemed as if she must quell every impulse in her except the yearnings of faithfulness and compassion. These revived impressions succeeded each other quickly and dreamily in Lydgate's mind while the tea was being brewed. He had shut his eyes in the last instant of reverie while he heard Dorothea saying, "Advise me, think what I can do. He has been all his life labouring and looking forward. He minds about nothing else, and I mind about nothing else." That voice of deep-souled womanhood had remained within him, as the enkindling conceptions of dead and sceptred genius had remained within him. Is there not a genius for feeling nobly, which also reigns over human spirits and their conclusions? The tones were a music from which he was falling away. He had really fallen into a momentary doze when Rosamond said in her silvery, neutral way,
"Here is your tea, Tertius,"
setting it on the small table by his side, and then moved back to her place, without looking at him. Lydgate was too hasty in attributing insensibility to her. After her own fashion, she was sensitive enough, and took lasting impressions. Her impression now was one of offence and repulsion. But then Rosamond had no scowls, and had never raised her voice. She was quite sure that no one could justly find fault with her. Perhaps Lydgate and she had never felt so far off each other before. But there were strong reasons for not deferring his revelation, even if he had not already begun it by that abrupt announcement. Indeed, some of the angry desire to rouse her into more sensibility on his account, which had prompted him to speak prematurely, still mingled with his pain in the prospect of her pain. But he waited till the tray was gone, the candles were lit, and the evening quiet might be counted on. The interval had left time for repelled tenderness to return into the old course. He spoke kindly.
"Dear Rosie, lay down your work and come and sit by me," he said, gently, pushing away the table and stretching out his arm to draw a chair near his own.
Rosamond obeyed. As she came towards him in her drapery of transparent, faintly tinted muslin, her slim yet round figure never looked more graceful. As she sat down by him and laid one hand on the elbow of his chair, at last looking at him and meeting his eyes, her delicate neck and cheek and purely cut lips never had more of that untarnished beauty which touches us in springtime and infancy and all sweet freshness. It touched Lydgate now, and mingled the early moments of his love for her with all the other memories which were stirred in this crisis of deep trouble. He laid his ample hand softly on hers, saying, "Dear," with the lingering utterance which affection gives to the word. Rosamond, too, was still under the power of that same past, and her husband was still, in part, the Lydgate whose approval had stirred delight. She put his hair lightly away from his forehead, then laid her other hand on his, and was conscious of forgiving him.
"I am obliged to tell you what will hurt you, Rosie. But there are things which husband and wife must think of together. I dare say it has occurred to you already that I am short of money."
Lydgate paused, but Rosamond turned her neck and looked at a vase on the mantelpiece.
"I was not able to pay for all the things we had to get before we were married, and there have been expenses since which I have been obliged to meet. The consequence is, there is a large debt at Brassing, £380, which has been pressing on me a good while. And in fact we are getting deeper every day, for people don't pay me the faster because others want the money. I took pains to keep it from you while you were not well, but now we must think together about it, and you must help me."
"What can I do, Tertius?" said Rosamond, turning her eyes on him again.
That little speech of four words, like so many others in all languages, is capable by varied vocal inflections of expressing all states of mind, from helpless dimness to exhaustive argumentative perception, from the completest self-devoting fellowship to the most neutral aloofness. Rosamond's thin utterance threw into the words, "What can I do?" as much neutrality as they could hold. They fell like a mortal chill on Lydgate's roused tenderness. He did not storm in indignation. He felt too sad a sinking of the heart. And when he spoke again, it was more in the tone of a man who forces himself to fulfil a task. "It is necessary for you to know, because I have to give security for a time, and a man must come to make an inventory of the furniture." Rosamond coloured deeply.
"Have you not asked Papa for money?" she said,
as soon as she could speak.
"No."
"Then I must ask him," she said,
releasing her hands from Lydgate's and rising to stand at 2 yards' distance from him.
"No, Rosie," said Lydgate decisively. "It is too late to do that. The inventory will be begun tomorrow. Remember, it is a mere security. It will make no difference. It is a temporary affair. I insist upon it that your father shall not know unless I choose to tell him," added Lydgate, with a more peremptory emphasis.
This certainly was unkind, but Rosamond had thrown him back on evil expectation as to what she would do in the way of quiet, steady disobedience. The unkindness seemed unpardonable to her. She was not given to weeping and disliked it, but now her chin and lips began to tremble, and the tears welled up. Perhaps it was not possible for Lydgate, under the double stress of outward material difficulty and of his own proud resistance to humiliating consequences, to imagine fully what this sudden trial was to a young creature who had known nothing but indulgence, and whose dreams had all been of new indulgence more exactly to her taste. But he did wish to spare her as much as he could, and her tears cut him to the heart. He could not speak again immediately. But Rosamond did not go on sobbing. She tried to conquer her agitation and wiped away her tears, continuing to look before her at the mantelpiece.
"Try not to grieve, darling," said Lydgate, turning his eyes up towards her.
That she had chosen to move away from him in this moment of her trouble made everything harder to say, but he must absolutely go on.
"We must brace ourselves to do what is necessary. It is I who have been in fault. I ought to have seen that I could not afford to live in this way. But many things have told against me in my practice, and it really just now has ebbed to a low point. I may recover it, but in the meantime we must pull up. We must change our way of living. We shall weather it. When I have given this security, I shall have time to look about me. And you are so clever that if you turn your mind to managing, you will school me into carefulness. I have been a thoughtless rascal about squaring prices. But come, dear, sit down and forgive me."
Lydgate was bowing his neck under the yoke like a creature who had talons, but who had reason too, which often reduces us to meekness. When he had spoken the last words in an imploring tone, Rosamond returned to the chair by his side. His self-blame gave her some hope that he would attend to her opinion, and she said,
"Why can you not put off having the inventory made? You can send the men away tomorrow when they come."
"I shall not send them away," said Lydgate, the peremptoriness rising again. Was it of any use to explain?
"If we left Middlemarch, there would of course be a sale, and that would do as well."
"But we are not going to leave Middlemarch."
"I am sure, Tertius, it would be much better to do so. Why can we not go to London, or near Durham, where your family is known?"
"We can go nowhere without money, Rosamond."
"Your friends would not wish you to be without money. And surely these odious tradesmen might be made to understand that, and to wait, if you would make proper representations to them."
"This is idle, Rosamond," said Lydgate angrily. "You must learn to take my judgment on questions you don't understand. I have made necessary arrangements, and they must be carried out. As to friends, I have no expectations whatever from them, and shall not ask them for anything."
Rosamond sat perfectly still. The thought in her mind was that if she had known how Lydgate would behave, she would never have married him. "We have no time to waste now on unnecessary words, dear," said Lydgate, trying to be gentle again. "There are some details that I want to consider with you. Dover says he will take a good deal of the plate back again, and any of the jewellery we like. He really behaves very well."
"Are we to go without spoons and forks, then?" said Rosamond,
whose very lips seemed to get thinner with the thinness of her utterance. She was determined to make no further resistance or suggestions.
"Oh, no, dear," said Lydgate. "But look here," he continued, drawing a paper from his pocket and opening it. "Here is Dover's account. See, I have marked a number of articles which, if we returned them, would reduce the amount by £30 and more. I have not marked any of the jewellery."
Lydgate had really felt this point of the jewellery very bitter to himself, but he had overcome the feeling by severe argument. He could not propose to Rosamond that she return any particular present of his, but he had told himself that he was bound to put Dover's offer before her, and her inward prompting might make the affair easy.
"It is useless for me to look, Tertius," said Rosamond calmly. "You will return what you please."
She would not turn her eyes on the paper, and Lydgate, flushing up to the roots of his hair, drew it back and let it fall on his knee. Meanwhile, Rosamond quietly went out of the room, leaving Lydgate helpless and wondering. Was she not coming back? It seemed that she had no more identified herself with him than if they had been creatures of different species and opposing interests. He tossed his head and thrust his hands deep into his pockets with a sort of vengeance. There was still science. There were still good objects to work for. He must give a tug still, all the stronger because other satisfactions were going. But the door opened and Rosamond re-entered. She carried the leather box containing the amethysts and a tiny ornamental basket which contained other boxes, and laying them on the chair where she had been sitting, she said, with perfect propriety in her air, "This is all the jewellery you ever gave me. You can return what you like of it, and of the plate also. You will not, of course, expect me to stay at home tomorrow. I shall go to Papa's." To many women, the look Lydgate cast at her would have been more terrible than one of anger. It had in it a despairing acceptance of the distance she was placing between them.
"And when shall you come back again?" he said, with a bitter edge on his accent.
"Oh, in the evening. Of course I shall not mention the subject to Mama." Rosamond was convinced that no woman could behave more irreproachably than she was behaving, and she went to sit down at her work-table. Lydgate sat meditating a minute or two, and the result was that he said, with some of the old emotion in his tone,
"Now we have been united, Rosie, you should not leave me to myself in the first trouble that has come."
"Certainly not," said Rosamond. "I shall do everything it becomes me to do."
"It is not right that the things should be left to servants, or that I should have to speak to them about it. And I shall be obliged to go out, I don't know how early. I understand your shrinking from the humiliation of these money affairs, but, my dear Rosamond, as a question of pride, which I feel just as much as you can, it is surely better to manage the thing ourselves and let the servants see as little of it as possible. And since you are my wife, there is no hindering your share in my disgraces, if there were disgraces."
Rosamond did not answer immediately, but at last she said, "Very well, I will stay at home."
"I shall not touch these jewels, Rosie. Take them away again. But I will write out a list of plate that we may return and that can be packed up and sent at once."
"The servants will know that," said Rosamond, with the slightest touch of sarcasm.
"Well, we must meet some disagreeables as necessities. Where is the ink, I wonder?" said Lydgate, rising and throwing the account on the larger table where he meant to write. Rosamond went to reach the inkstand, and after setting it on the table was going to turn away, when Lydgate, who was standing close by, put his arm round her and drew her towards him, saying, "Come, darling, let us make the best of things. It will only be for a time, I hope, that we shall have to be stingy and particular. Kiss me." His native warm-heartedness took a great deal of quenching, and it is a part of manliness for a husband to feel keenly the fact that an inexperienced girl has got into trouble by marrying him. She received his kiss and returned it faintly, and in this way an appearance of accord was recovered for the time. But Lydgate could not help looking forward with dread to the inevitable future discussions about expenditure and the necessity for a complete change in their way of living.
Chapter 59. News is often dispersed as thoughtlessly and effectively as that pollen which the bees carry off, having no idea how powdery they are, when they are buzzing in search of their particular nectar. This fine comparison has reference to Fred Vincey, who on that evening at Lowick Parsonage heard a lively discussion among the ladies on the news which their old servant had got from Tantrip concerning Mr. Casaubon's strange mention of Mr. Ladislaw in a codicil to his will made not long before his death. Miss Winifred was astounded to find that her brother had known the fact before, and observed that Camden was the most wonderful man for knowing things and not telling them, whereupon Mary Garth said that the codicil had perhaps got mixed up with the habits of spiders, which Miss Winifred never would listen to. Mrs. Fairbrother considered that the news had something to do with their having only once seen Mr. Ladislaw at Lowick, and Miss Noble made many small, compassionate mewings. Fred knew little and cared less about Ladislaw and the Casaubons, and his mind never recurred to that discussion, till one day, calling on Rosamond at his mother's request to deliver a message as he passed, he happened to see Ladislaw going away. Fred and Rosamond had little to say to each other, now that marriage had removed her from collision with the unpleasantness of brothers, and especially now that he had taken what she held the stupid and even reprehensible step of giving up the church to take to such a business as Mr. Garth's. Hence Fred talked, by preference, of what he considered indifferent news, and, apropos of that young Ladislaw, mentioned what he had heard at Lowick Parsonage. Now Lydgate, like Mr. Fairbrother, knew a great deal more than he told, and when he had once been set thinking about the relation between Will and Dorothea, his conjectures had gone beyond the fact. He imagined that there was a passionate attachment on both sides, and this struck him as much too serious to gossip about. He remembered Will's irritability when he had mentioned Mrs. Casaubon, and was the more circumspect. On the whole, his surmises, in addition to what he knew of the fact, increased his friendliness and tolerance towards Ladislaw, and made him understand the vacillation which kept him at Middlemarch after he had said that he should go away. It was significant of the separateness between Lydgate's mind and Rosamond's, that he had no impulse to speak to her on the subject. Indeed, he did not quite trust her reticence towards Will. And he was right there, though he had no vision of the way in which her mind would act in urging her to speak. When she had repeated Fred's news to Lydgate, he said, "Take care you don't drop the faintest hint to Ladislaw, Rosie. He is likely to fly out as if you insulted him. Of course it is a painful affair." Rosamond turned her neck and patted her hair, looking the image of placid indifference. But the next time Will came when Lydgate was away, she spoke archly about his not going to London as he had threatened.
"I know all about it. I have a confidential little bird," said she, showing very pretty airs of her head over the bit of work held high between her active fingers. "There is a powerful magnet in this neighbourhood."
"To be sure there is. Nobody knows that better than you," said Will, with light gallantry, but inwardly prepared to be angry.
"It is really the most charming romance. Mr. Casaubon jealous, and foreseeing that there was no one else whom Mrs. Casaubon would like so much to marry, and no one who would so much like to marry her, as a certain gentleman, and then laying a plan to spoil all by making her forfeit her property if she did marry that gentleman, and then, oh, I have no doubt the end will be thoroughly romantic."
"Great God, what do you mean?" said Will, flushing over face and ears, his features seeming to change as if he had had a violent shake. "Don't joke. Tell me what you mean."
"You don't really know," said Rosamond,
no longer playful, and desiring nothing better than to tell, in order that she might evoke effects.
"No," he returned impatiently.
"Don't know that Mr. Casaubon has left it in his will that if Mrs. Casaubon marries you, she is to forfeit all her property?"
"How do you know that it is true?" said Will eagerly.
"My brother Fred heard it from the Fairbrothers."
Will started up from his chair and reached his hat.
"I dare say she likes you better than the property," said Rosamond, looking at him from a distance.
"Pray don't say any more about it," said Will, in a hoarse undertone extremely unlike his usual light voice. "It is a foul insult to her and to me."
Then he sat down absently, looking before him but seeing nothing.
"Now you are angry with me," said Rosamond. "It is too bad to bear me malice. You ought to be obliged to me for telling you."
"So I am," said Will abruptly, speaking with that kind of double soul which belongs to dreamers who answer questions.
"I expect to hear of the marriage," said Rosamond playfully.
"Never. You will never hear of the marriage."
With those words uttered impetuously, Will rose, put out his hand to Rosamond, still with the air of a somnambulist, and went away. When he was gone, Rosamond left her chair and walked to the other end of the room, leaning when she got there against a chiffonniere and looking out of the window wearily. She was oppressed by ennui, and by that dissatisfaction which in women's minds is continually turning into a trivial jealousy, referring to no real claims, springing from no deeper passion than the vague exactingness of egoism, and yet capable of impelling action as well as speech.
"There really is nothing to care for much," said poor Rosamond inwardly, thinking of the family at Quallingham who did not write to her, and that perhaps Tertius, when he came home, would tease her about expenses. She had already secretly disobeyed him by asking her father to help them, and he had ended decisively by saying, "I am more likely to want help myself."
Chapter 60. A few days afterwards, it was already the end of August, there was an occasion which caused some excitement in Middlemarch. The public, if it chose, was to have the advantage of buying, under the distinguished auspices of Mr. Borthrop Trumbull, the furniture, books, and pictures, which anybody might see by the handbills to be the best in every kind, belonging to Edwin Larcher, Esquire. This was not one of the sales indicating the depression of trade. On the contrary, it was due to Mr. Larcher's great success in the carrying business, which warranted his purchase of a mansion near Riverston, already furnished in high style by an illustrious spa physician, furnished indeed with such large framefuls of expensive flesh painting in the dining room that Mrs. Larcher was nervous, until reassured by finding the subjects to be scriptural. Hence the fine opportunity to purchasers, which was well pointed out in the handbills of Mr. Borthrop Trumbull, whose acquaintance with the history of art enabled him to state that the hall furniture, to be sold without reserve, comprised a piece of carving by a contemporary of Gibbons. At Middlemarch in those times, a large sale was regarded as a kind of festival. There was a table spread with the best cold eatables, as at a superior funeral, and facilities were offered for that generous drinking of cheerful glasses, which might lead to generous and cheerful bidding for undesirable articles. Mr. Larcher's sale was the more attractive in the fine weather, because the house stood just at the end of the town, with a garden and stables attached, in that pleasant issue from Middlemarch called the London Road, which was also the road to the new hospital, and to Mr. Bulstrode's retired residence known as the Shrubs. In short, the auction was as good as a fair, and drew all classes with leisure at command. To some, who risked making bids in order simply to raise prices, it was almost equal to betting at the races. The second day, when the best furniture was to be sold, everybody was there. Even Mr. Thesiger, the rector of St. Peter's, had looked in for a short time, wishing to buy the carved table, and had rubbed elbows with Mr. Bambridge and Mr. Horrock. There was a wreath of Middlemarch ladies, accommodated with seats round the large table in the dining room, where Mr. Borthrop Trumbull was mounted with desk and hammer. But the rows chiefly of masculine faces behind were often varied by incomings and outgoings, both from the door and the large bow window opening onto the lawn. Everybody that day did not include Mr. Bulstrode, whose health could not well endure crowds and draughts, but Mrs. Bulstrode had particularly wished to have a certain picture, a supper at Emmaus, attributed in the catalogue to Guido. And at the last moment before the day of the sale, Mr. Bulstrode had called at the office of the Pioneer, of which he was now one of the proprietors, to beg of Mr. Ladislaw as a great favour that he would obligingly use his remarkable knowledge of pictures on behalf of Mrs. Bulstrode, and judge of the value of this particular painting, if, added the scrupulously polite banker,
attendance at the sale would not interfere with the arrangements for your departure, which I know is imminent.
This proviso might have sounded rather satirically in Will's ear if he had been in a mood to care about such satire. It referred to an understanding entered into many weeks before with the proprietors of the paper that he should be at liberty any day he pleased to hand over the management to the sub-editor whom he had been training, since he wished finally to quit Middlemarch. But indefinite visions of ambition are weak against the ease of doing what is habitual or beguilingly agreeable, and we all know the difficulty of carrying out a resolve when we secretly long that it may turn out to be unnecessary. In such states of mind, the most incredulous person has a private leaning towards miracle. Impossible to conceive how our wish could be fulfilled. Still, very wonderful things have happened. Will did not confess this weakness to himself, but he lingered. What was the use of going to London at that time of the year? The Rugby men who would remember him were not there, and so far as political writing was concerned, he would rather for a few weeks go on with the Pioneer. At the present moment, however, when Mr. Bulstrode was speaking to him, he had both a strengthened resolve to go and an equally strong resolve not to go till he had once more seen Dorothea. Hence he replied that he had reasons for deferring his departure a little and would be happy to go to the sale. Will was in a defiant mood, his consciousness being deeply stung with the thought that the people who looked at him probably knew a fact tantamount to an accusation against him as a fellow with low designs which were to be frustrated by a disposal of property. Like most people who assert their freedom with regard to conventional distinction, he was prepared to be sudden and quick at quarrel with anyone who might hint that he had personal reasons for that assertion, that there was anything in his blood, his bearing, or his character, to which he gave the mask of an opinion. When he was under an irritating impression of this kind, he would go about for days with a defiant look, the colour changing in his transparent skin, as if he were on the qui vive, watching for something which he had to dart upon. This expression was peculiarly noticeable in him at the sale, and those who had only seen him in his moods of gentle oddity or of bright enjoyment would have been struck with a contrast. He was not sorry to have this occasion for appearing in public before the Middlemarch tribes of Toller, Hackbutt and the rest, who looked down on him as an adventurer and were in a state of brutal ignorance about Dante, who sneered at his Polish blood and were themselves of a breed very much in need of crossing. He stood in a conspicuous place not far from the auctioneer, with a forefinger in each side pocket and his head thrown backward, not caring to speak to anybody, though he had been cordially welcomed as a connoisseur by Mr. Trumbull, who was enjoying the utmost activity of his great faculties. And surely, among all men whose vocation requires them to exhibit their powers of speech, the happiest is a prosperous provincial auctioneer, keenly alive to his own jokes and sensible of his encyclopedic knowledge. Some saturnine, sour-blooded persons might object to be constantly insisting on the merits of all articles from bootjacks to Berghams. But Mr. Borthrop Trumbull had a kindly liquid in his veins. He was an admirer by nature, and would have liked to have the universe under his hammer, feeling that it would go at a higher figure for his recommendation. Meanwhile, Mrs. Larcher's drawing-room furniture was enough for him. When Will Ladislaw had come in, a second fender, said to have been forgotten in its right place, suddenly claimed the auctioneer's enthusiasm, which he distributed on the equitable principle of praising those things most which were most in need of praise. The fender was of polished steel, with much lancet-shaped openwork and a sharp edge.
"Now, ladies," said he, "I shall appeal to you. Here is a fender which at any other sale would hardly be offered without reserve, being, as I may say, for quality of steel and quaintness of design, a kind of thing..."
Here Mr. Trumbull dropped his voice and became slightly nasal, trimming his outlines with his left finger.
"That might not fall in with ordinary tastes. Allow me to tell you that by and by this style of workmanship will be the only one in vogue. Half a crown, you said? Thank you. Going at half a crown, this characteristic fender. And I have particular information that the antique style is very much sought after in high quarters. 3 shillings? 3 and 6pence? Hold it well up, Joseph. Look, ladies, at the chastity of the design. I have no doubt myself that it was turned out in the last century. 4 shillings, Mr. Malmsey? 4 shillings.
"It's not a thing I would put in my drawing room," said Mrs. Malmsey, audibly for the warning of the rash husband. "I wonder at Mrs. Larcher. Every blessed child's head that fell against it would be cut in two. The edge is like a knife."
"Quite true," rejoined Mr. Trumbull, quickly, "and most uncommonly useful to have a fender at hand that will cut, if you have a leather shoe tie or a bit of string that wants cutting and no knife at hand. Many a man has been left hanging because there was no knife to cut him down. gentlemen, here's a fender that, if you had the misfortune to hang yourselves, would cut you down in no time, with astonishing celerity. 4 and 6pence? 5? 5 and 6pence? An appropriate thing for a spare bedroom, where there was a four-poster and a guest a little out of his mind. 6 shillings? Thank you, Mr. Clintup. Going at 6 shillings. Going. Gone.
The auctioneer's glance, which had been searching round him with a preternatural susceptibility to all signs of bidding, here dropped on the paper before him, and his voice too dropped into a tone of indifferent dispatch as he said,
"Mr. Clintup, be handy, Joseph." "It was worth 6 shillings to have a fender you could always tell that joke on," said Mr. Clintup,
laughing low and apologetically to his next neighbour. He was a diffident though distinguished nurseryman, and feared that the audience might regard his bid as a foolish one. Meanwhile, Joseph had brought a tray full of small articles.
"Now, ladies," said Mr. Trumbull, taking up one of the articles, "this tray contains a very churchy lot, a collection of trifles for the drawing-room table, and trifles make the sum of human things. Nothing more important than trifles." "Yes, Mr. Ladislaw, yes, by and by. But pass the tray round, Joseph. These bee jews must be examined, ladies. This I have in my hand is an ingenious contrivance, a sort of practical rebus, I may call it. Here, you see, it looks like an elegant, heart-shaped box, portable, for the pocket. There, again, it becomes like a splendid double flower, an ornament for the table. And now..." Mr. Trumbull allowed the flower to fall alarmingly into strings of heart-shaped leaves.
"A book of riddles! No less than 500, printed in a beautiful red. Gentlemen, if I had less of a conscience, I should not wish you to bid high for this lot. I have a longing for it myself. What can promote innocent mirth, and, I may say, virtue, more than a good riddle? It hinders profane language, and attaches a man to the society of refined females. This ingenious article itself, without the elegant domino box, card basket, etc., ought alone to give a high price to the lot. Carried in the pocket, it might make an individual welcome in any society. 4 shillings, sir. 4 shillings for this remarkable collection of riddles with the etceteras. Here is a sample. How must you spell honey to make it catch ladybirds? Answer, money. You hear? Ladybirds, honey, money. This is an amusement to sharpen the intellect. It has a sting. It has what we call satire and wit without indecency. 4 and 6pence, 5 shillings.
The bidding ran on with warming rivalry. Mr. Bowyer was a bidder, and this was too exasperating. Bowyer couldn't afford it, and only wanted to hinder every other man from making a figure. The current carried even Mr. Horrock with it. But this committal of himself to an opinion fell from him with so little sacrifice of his neutral expression that the bid might not have been detected as his but for the friendly oaths of Mr. Bambridge, who wanted to know what Horrock would do with the blasted stuff, only fit for haberdashers given over to that state of perdition which the horse-dealer so cordially recognised in the majority of earthly existences. The lot was finally knocked down at a guinea to Mr. Spilkins, a young slender of the neighbourhood, who was reckless with his pocket-money, and felt his want of memory for riddles.
"Come, Trumbull, this is too bad. You've been putting some old maid's rubbish into the sale," murmured Mr. Toller, getting close to the auctioneer. "I want to see how the prints go, and I must be off soon."
"Immediately, Mr. Toller. It was only an act of benevolence which your noble heart would approve. Joseph, quick with the prints. Lot 235. Now, gentlemen, you who are connoisseurs, you are going to have a treat. Here is an engraving of the Duke of Wellington surrounded by his staff on the field of Waterloo, and notwithstanding recent events which have, as it were, enveloped our great hero in a cloud, I will be bold to say, for a man in my line must not be blown about by political winds, that a finer subject of the modern order belonging to our own time and epoch, the understanding of man could hardly conceive. Angels might, perhaps, but not men, sirs, not men."
"Who painted it?" said Mr. Powderall, much impressed.
"It is a proof before the letter, Mr. Powderall. The painter is... not known,"
answered Trumbull, with a certain gaspingness in his last words, after which he pursed up his lips and stared round him.
"I'll bid a pound," said Mr. Powderall, in a tone of resolved emotion,
as of a man ready to put himself in the breach. Whether from awe or pity, nobody raised the price on him. Next came two Dutch prints which Mr. Toller had been eager for, and after he had secured them, he went away. Other prints, and afterwards some paintings, were sold to leading Middlemarchers who had come with a special desire for them, and there was a more active movement of the audience in and out, some who had bought what they wanted going away, others coming in either quite newly or from a temporary visit to the refreshments, which were spread under the marquee on the lawn. It was this marquee that Mr. Bambridge was bent on buying, and he appeared to like looking inside it frequently as a foretaste of its possession. On the last occasion of his return from it, he was observed to bring with him a new companion, a stranger to Mr. Trumbull and everyone else, whose appearance, however, led to the supposition that he might be a relative of the horse-dealer's, also given to indulgence. His large whiskers, imposing swagger and swing of the leg, made him a striking figure, but his suit of black, rather shabby at the edges, caused the prejudicial inference that he was not able to afford himself as much indulgence as he liked.
"Who is it you've picked up, Bam?" said Mr. Horrock aside.
"Ask him yourself," returned Mr. Bambridge. "He said he'd just turned in from the road."
Mr. Horrock eyed the stranger, who was leaning back against his stick with one hand, using his toothpick with the other, and looking about him with a certain restlessness apparently under the silence imposed on him by circumstances. At length the supper at Emmaus was brought forward, to Will's immense relief, for he was getting so tired of the proceedings that he had drawn back a little and leaned his shoulder against the wall just behind the auctioneer. He now came forward again, and his eye caught the conspicuous stranger, who rather to his surprise was staring at him markedly. But Will was immediately appealed to by Mr. Trumbull.
"Yes, Mr. Ladislaw, yes. This interests you as a connoisseur, I think. It is some pleasure," the auctioneer went on with a rising fervour, "to have a picture like this to show to a company of ladies and gentlemen, a picture worth any sum to an individual whose means were on a level with his judgment. It is a painting of the Italian school, by the celebrated Guido, the greatest painter in the world, the chief of the old masters, as they are called. I take it because they were up to a thing or two beyond most of us, in possession of secrets now lost to the bulk of mankind. Let me tell you, gentlemen, I have seen a great many pictures by the old masters, and they are not all up to this mark. Some of them are darker than you might like, and not family subjects. But here is a Guido. The frame alone is worth pounds, which any lady might be proud to hang up. A suitable thing for what we call a refectory in a charitable institution. If any gentleman of the corporation wished to show his munificence... Turn it a little, sir? Yes, Joseph, turn it a little to Mr. Ladislaw. Mr. Ladislaw, having been abroad, understands the merit of these things, you observe."
All eyes were for a moment turned towards Will, who said coolly, "£5." The auctioneer burst out in deep remonstrance.
"Ah, Mr. Ladislaw, the frame alone is worth that. Ladies and gentlemen, for the credit of the town, suppose it should be discovered hereafter that a gem of art has been amongst us in this town, and nobody in Middlemarch awake to it. 5 guineas, 5.76, 5.10. Still, ladies, still, it is a gem, and full many a gem, as the poet says, has been allowed to go at a nominal price because the public knew no better, because it was offered in circles where there was, I was going to say, a low feeling, but no. £6, 6 guineas. A Guido of the first order going at 6 guineas, it is an insult to religion, ladies. It touches us all as Christians, gentlemen, that a subject like this should go at such a low figure. £6, 10? 7.
The bidding was brisk, and Will continued to share in it, remembering that Mrs. Bulstrode had a strong wish for the picture, and thinking that he might stretch the price to £12. But it was knocked down to him at 10 guineas, whereupon he pushed his way towards the bow window and went out. He chose to go under the marquee to get a glass of water, being hot and thirsty. It was empty of other visitors, and he asked the woman in attendance to fetch him some fresh water. But before she was well gone, he was annoyed to see, entering, the florid stranger who had stared at him. It struck Will at this moment that the man might be one of those political parasitic insects of the bloated kind who had once or twice claimed acquaintance with him as having heard him speak on the reform question, and who might think of getting a shilling by news. In this light, his person, already rather heating to behold on a summer's day, appeared the more disagreeable, and Will, half seated on the elbow of a garden chair, turned his eyes carefully away from the corner. But this signified little to our acquaintance Mr. Raffles, who never hesitated to thrust himself on unwilling observation if it suited his purpose to do so. He moved a step or two till he was in front of Will, and said with full-mouthed haste,
"Excuse me, Mr. Ladislaw. Was your mother's name Sarah Dunkirk?"
Will, starting to his feet, moved backward a step, frowning and saying with some fierceness, "Yes, sir, it was. And what is that to you?" It was in Will's nature that the first spark it threw out was a direct answer of the question and a challenge of the consequences. To have said, "What is that to you?" in the first instance would have seemed like shuffling, as if he minded who knew anything about his origin. Raffles, on his side, had not the same eagerness for a collision which was implied in Ladislaw's threatening air. The slim young fellow with his girl's complexion looked like a tiger cat ready to spring on him. Under such circumstances, Mr. Raffles's pleasure in annoying his company was kept in abeyance.
"No offence, my good sir, no offence. I only remember your mother, knew her when she was a girl. But it is your father that you feature, sir. I had the pleasure of seeing your father, too. Parents alive, Mr. Ladislaw?"
"No,"
thundered Will, in the same attitude as before.
"Should be glad to do you a service, Mr. Ladislaw. By Jove, I should. Hope to meet again."
Hereupon, Raffles, who had lifted his hat with the last words, turned himself round with a swing of his leg and walked away. Will looked after him a moment, and could see that he did not re-enter the auction room, but appeared to be walking towards the road. For an instant, he thought that he had been foolish not to let the man go on talking. But no, on the whole, he preferred doing without knowledge from that source. Later in the evening, however, Raffles overtook him in the street, and appearing either to have forgotten the roughness of his former reception, or to intend avenging it by a forgiving familiarity, greeted him jovially and walked by his side, remarking at first on the pleasantness of the town and neighbourhood. Will at first suspected that the man had been drinking, and was considering how to shake him off, when Raffles said,
"I've been abroad myself, Mr. Ladislaw. I've seen the world. Used to parlez-vous a little? It was at Boulogne I saw your father. A most uncommon likeness you are of him, by Jove. Mouth, nose, eyes, hair turned off your brow just like this, a little in the foreign style. John Bull doesn't do much of that. But your father was very ill when I saw him. Lord, Lord, hands you might see through. You were a small youngster then. Did he get well?"
"No," said Will curtly.
"Ah, well, I've often wondered what became of your mother. She ran away from her friends when she was a young lass, a proud, spirited lass, and pretty, by Jove. I knew the reason why she ran away," said Raffles, winking slowly as he looked sideways at Will.
"You know nothing dishonourable of her, sir," said Will, turning on him rather savagely. But Mr. Raffles just now was not sensitive to shades of manner.
"Not a bit," said he, tossing his head decisively. "She was a little too honourable to like her friends. That was it."
Here Raffles again winked slowly.
"Lord bless you, I knew all about 'em. A little in what you may call the respectable thieving line. The high style of receiving house. None of your holes and corners. First rate, slap up shop, high profits, and no mistake. But, Lord, Sarah would have known nothing about it. A dashing young lady she was. Fine boarding school, fit for a lord's wife. Only Archie Duncan threw it at her out of spite, because she would have nothing to do with him. And so she ran away from the whole concern. I travelled for him, sir, in a gentlemanly way, at a high salary. They didn't mind her running away at first. Godly folk, sir, very godly. and she was for the stage. The son was alive then, and the daughter was at a discount. Hello, here we are at the Blue Bull. What do you say, Mr. Ladislaw? Shall we turn in and have a glass?
No, I must say good evening, said Will,
dashing up a passage which led to Lowick Gate, and almost running to get out of Raffles' reach. He walked a long while on the Lowick Road away from the town, glad of the starlit darkness when it came. He felt as if he had had dirt cast on him, amidst shouts of scorn. There was this to confirm the fellow's statement, that his mother never would tell him the reason why she had run away from her family. Well, what was he, Will Ladislaw, the worse, supposing the truth about that family to be the ugliest? His mother had braved hardship in order to separate herself from it. But if Dorothea's friends had known this story, if the Chethams had known it, they would have had a fine colour to give their suspicions, a welcome ground for thinking him unfit to come near her. However, let them suspect what they pleased, they would find themselves in the wrong. They would find out that the blood in his veins was as free from the taint of meanness as theirs. Chapter 61. The same night, when Mr. Bulstrode returned from a journey to Brassing on business, his good wife met him in the entrance hall and drew him into his private sitting room.
"Nicholas," she said, fixing her honest eyes upon him anxiously,
"there has been such a disagreeable man here asking for you. It has made me quite uncomfortable."
"What kind of man, my dear?" said Mr. Bulstrode, dreadfully certain of the answer.
"A red-faced man with large whiskers and most impudent in his manner. He declared he was an old friend of yours, and said you would be sorry not to see him. He wanted to wait for you here, but I told him he could see you at the bank tomorrow. Most impudent he was, stared at me, and said his friend Nick had luck in wives. I don't believe he would have gone away if Blucher had not happened to break his chain and come running round on the gravel, for I was in the garden. So I said, 'You'd better go away. The dog is very fierce, and I can't hold him.' Do you really know anything of such a man?"
"I believe I know who he is, my dear," said Bulstrode, in his usual subdued voice. "An unfortunate, dissolute wretch, whom I helped too much in days gone by. However, I presume you will not be troubled by him again. He will probably come to the bank, to beg, doubtless." No more was said on the subject until the next day, when Mr. Bulstrode had returned from the town and was dressing for dinner. His wife, not sure that he was come home, looked into his dressing-room and saw him with his coat and cravat off, leaning one arm on a chest of drawers and staring absently at the ground. He started nervously and looked up as she entered.
"You look very ill, Nicholas. Is there anything the matter?"
"I have a good deal of pain in my head," said Mr. Bulstrode, who was so frequently ailing that his wife was always ready to believe in this cause of depression.
"Sit down and let me sponge it with vinegar."
Physically, Mr. Bulstrode did not want the vinegar, but morally the affectionate attention soothed him. Though always polite, it was his habit to receive such services with marital coolness, as his wife's duty. But today, while she was bending over him, he said,
"You are very good, Harriet,"
in a tone which had something new in it to her ear. She did not know exactly what the novelty was, but her woman's solicitude shaped itself into a darting thought that he might be going to have an illness.
"Has anything worried you?" she said. "Did that man come to you at the bank?"
"Yes, and it was as I had supposed. He is a man who at one time might have done better, but he has sunk into a drunken, debauched creature."
"Is he quite gone away?"
said Mrs. Bulstrode anxiously. But for certain reasons she refrained from adding, "It was very disagreeable to hear him calling himself a friend of yours." At that moment she would not have liked to say anything which implied her habitual consciousness that her husband's earlier connections were not quite on a level with her own. Not that she knew much about them. that her husband had at first been employed in a bank, that he had afterwards entered into what he called city business and gained a fortune before he was 33, that he had married a widow who was much older than himself, a dissenter, and in other ways probably of that disadvantageous quality usually perceptible in a first wife, if inquired into with the dispassionate judgment of a second, was almost as much as she had cared to learn, beyond the glimpses which Mr. Bulstrode's narrative occasionally gave of his early bent towards religion, his inclination to be a preacher, and his association with missionary and philanthropic efforts. She believed in him as an excellent man whose piety carried a peculiar eminence in belonging to a layman, whose influence had turned her own mind towards seriousness, and whose share of perishable good had been the means of raising her own position. But she also liked to think that it was well in every sense for Mr. Bulstrode to have won the hand of Harriet Vincey, whose family was undeniable in a Middlemarch light. A better light, surely, than any thrown in London thoroughfares or dissenting chapel yards. The unreformed provincial mind distrusted London, and while true religion was everywhere saving, honest Mrs. Bulstrode was convinced that to be saved in the church was more respectable. She so much wished to ignore towards others that her husband had ever been a London dissenter that she liked to keep it out of sight even in talking to him. He was quite aware of this. Indeed, in some respects, he was rather afraid of this ingenuous wife, whose imitative piety and native worldliness were equally sincere, who had nothing to be ashamed of, and whom he had married out of a thorough inclination still subsisting. But his fears were such as belong to a man who cares to maintain his recognised supremacy. The loss of high consideration from his wife, as from everyone else who did not clearly hate him out of enmity to the truth, would be as the beginning of death to him. When she said, "Is he quite gone away?"
"Oh, I trust so,"
he answered, with an effort to throw as much sober unconcern into his tone as possible. But in truth, Mr. Bulstrode was very far from a state of quiet trust. In the interview at the bank, Raffles had made it evident that his eagerness to torment was almost as strong in him as any other greed. He had frankly said that he had turned out of the way to come to Middlemarch, just to look about him and see whether the neighbourhood would suit him to live in. He had certainly had a few debts to pay more than he expected, but the £200 were not gone yet. A cool 25 would suffice him to go away with for the present. What he had wanted chiefly was to see his friend Nick and family, and know all about the prosperity of a man to whom he was so much attached. By and by, he might come back for a longer stay. This time, Raffles declined to be seen off the premises, as he expressed it, declined to quit Middlemarch under Bulstrode's eyes. He meant to go by coach the next day, if he chose. Bulstrode felt himself helpless. Neither threats nor coaxing could avail. He could not count on any persistent fear, nor on any promise. On the contrary, he felt a cold certainty at his heart that Raffles, unless Providence sent death to hinder him, would come back to Middlemarch before long. And that certainly was a terror. It was not that he was in danger of legal punishment or of beggary. He was in danger only of seeing disclosed, to the judgment of his neighbours and the mournful perception of his wife, certain facts of his past life which would render him an object of scorn and an opprobrium of the religion with which he had diligently associated himself. The terror of being judged sharpens the memory. It sends an inevitable glare over that long unvisited past, which has been habitually recalled only in general phrases. Even without memory, the life is bound into one by a zone of dependence in growth and decay. But intense memory forces a man to own his blameworthy past. With memory set smarting like a reopened wound, a man's past is not simply a dead history, an outworn preparation of the present. It is not a repented error shaken loose from the life. It is a still, quivering part of himself, bringing shudders and bitter flavours and the tinglings of a merited shame. Into this second life, Bulstrode's past had now risen, only the pleasures of it seeming to have lost their quality. Night and day, without interruption save of brief sleep, which only wove retrospect and fear into a fantastic present. He felt the scenes of his earlier life coming between him and everything else as obstinately as when we look through the window from a lighted room. The objects we turn our backs on are still before us, instead of the grass and the trees. The successive events, inward and outward, were there in one view. Though each might be dwelt on in turn, the rest still kept their hold in the consciousness. Once more he saw himself the young banker's clerk, with an agreeable person, as clever in figures as he was fluent in speech, and fond of theological definition. An eminent though young member of a Calvinistic dissenting church at Highbury, having had striking experience in conviction of sin and sense of pardon. Again he heard himself called for as Brother Bulstrode in prayer meetings, speaking on religious platforms, preaching in private houses. Again he felt himself thinking of the ministry as possibly his vocation, and inclined towards missionary labour. That was the happiest time of his life. That was the spot he would have chosen now to awake in and find the rest a dream. The people among whom Brother Bulstrode was distinguished were very few, but they were very near to him, and stirred his satisfaction the more. His power stretched through a narrow space, but he felt its effect the more intensely. He believed without effort in the peculiar work of grace within him, and in the signs that God intended him for special instrumentality. Then came the moment of transition. It was with the sense of promotion he had when he, an orphan educated at a commercial charity school, was invited to a fine villa belonging to Mr. Dunkirk, the richest man in the congregation. Soon he became an intimate there, honoured for his piety by the wife, marked out for his ability by the husband, whose wealth was due to a flourishing city and West End trade. That was the setting in of a new current for his ambition, directing his prospects of instrumentality towards the uniting of distinguished religious gifts with successful business. By and by came a decided external leading. A confidential subordinate partner died, and nobody seemed to the principal so well fitted to fill the severely felt vacancy as his young friend Bulstrode, if he would become confidential accountant. The offer was accepted. The business was a pawnbroker's, of the most magnificent sort both in extent and profits, and on a short acquaintance with it, Bulstrode became aware that one source of magnificent profit was the easy reception of any goods offered without strict inquiry as to where they came from. But there was a branch house at the West End, and no pettiness or dinginess to give suggestions of shame. He remembered his first moments of shrinking. They were private, and were filled with arguments, some of these taking the form of prayer. The business was established and had old roots. Is it not one thing to set up a new gin palace, and another to accept an investment in an old one? The profits made out of lost souls? Where can the line be drawn at which they begin in human transactions? Was it not even God's way of saving his chosen? Thou knowest, the young Bulstrode had said then, as the older Bulstrode was saying now, thou knowest how loose my soul sits from these things, how I view them all as implements for tilling thy garden, rescued here and there from the wilderness. Metaphors and precedents were not wanting. Peculiar spiritual experiences were not wanting, which at last made the retention of his position seem a service demanded of him. The vista of a fortune had already opened itself, and Bulstrode's shrinking remained private. Mr. Dunkirk had never expected that there would be any shrinking at all. He had never conceived that trade had anything to do with the scheme of salvation. And it was true that Bulstrode found himself carrying on two distinct lives. His religious activity could not be incompatible with his business, as soon as he had argued himself into not feeling it incompatible.
End of Disc 19.